Malcolm Honlein with us. It's the weekly update. Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Mr. Honlein, a pleasure to welcome you back to JM and the AM.
Thank you. It's always good to be with you.
So we'll start with this because I mentioned it just a moment ago. Rabbi Tzvi Kogan was the victim of a kidnapping and murder. Most of us, who follow the news know the story now. And we know that the commitment of the Chabad Shluchim is pretty amazing. And here it happened in Dubai. But what got me, in addition to the terrible tragedy, which was felt by the worldwide Jewish community, what got me is the reaction of the UAE government, their commitment, their public commitment to safety, their intolerance of any of these types of activities. And frankly, I wish that other societies that we are even more familiar with took this type of attitude when it comes to public safety. Do we consider this an isolated episode? Was this ordered by some government, by some terrorist sponsoring government? What do we know about this episode or by Kogan's murder?
Okay, so first of all, it is a tragic loss. He was young and had been married 2 years. He ran a kosher supermarket, but was known as one person in Dubai. One of the leaders of the community there said to me he was an angel. Anybody who needed anything, they called on him, and that he was like a son in my family. We don't know the details yet, and people are rushing to a lot of conclusions. The fact is that the government of the UAE came out pretty strongly with statements, and the vice ambassador went to visit the family during Shiva. But the public pronouncements by Ambassador Otaiba, the UAE ambassador in Washington, as well as officials in Dubai, were strong statements of condemnation, and they worked right away to apprehend the three who went to Turkey. It's an unusual operation. The three traveled together, were obviously being surveilled the whole time, and the government of Turkey cooperated and extradited them to right away to the UAE, where they will stand trial. What is surprising is that we've heard no details from the interrogations and from of the suspects of the perpetrators, and whether Iran ordered this, whether this had some other implication, why they chose this one individual, except the fact that he was a very visible Jew, is yet to be, if not determined, at least to be made public.
Now, I know that this is not really our topic generally, but I'm curious to get your reaction to it. The statements from the government in the UAE about the public safety of their citizens. I mean, frankly, and I know that there's no comparison, but sometimes it gets you thinking. You would like to see in our own country this type of attitude toward criminal behavior. And when people go ahead and act inappropriately in public settings, especially at the peril of other individuals, you would like to see public safety, you'd like to see elected and public officials take the public safety attitude that the UAE government took.
Yeah, so there were some questions raised that the police didn't respond immediately. It seems that this was 150 kilometers from Dubai. It was near the border with Oman. And they immediately did the search. They found the car, and then they found the body. And then the statements, as I said, were condemnatory. And clearly the Jewish community in Dubai has lived relatively peacefully. There were periodic incidents. People tell me that they increased. Remember, there are a lot of Iranians in Dubai, a lot. A lot of the commerce goes through there. It's a way of avoiding sanctions on Iran. The Iranian businessmen are located in Dubai in very large numbers and have been for a long time. The government of UAE does act independently. It has been less cordial, I think, to Iran than, let's say, Saudi Arabia has been of late. We've seen pictures of the Saudi head of forces and the counterpart from Iran meeting together, pledging to meet again, and even countries doing border exercises with Iran. We haven't seen those kind of measures by the government of UAE, which has really been the forefront, and I think is the most successful continuously of the Abraham Accord countries in terms of trade not stopping, the flights to Dubai not stopping from the UAE to Israel. So those things should be acknowledged and saluted. I hope we will find out much more about who was behind this, but ultimately, whether they're directly involved or not, Iran is responsible for poisoning the oil, providing weapons, as we see in Lebanon, the degree to which they have, even in recent years, been able to get through very sophisticated weapons to the enemies of Israel and are providing to the militias in Syria and Iraq much more advanced weapons. It's easier for them to get it to Iraq than it is to Lebanon. And many people feared there would be a new front, which was opened. There were drones and other things from Iraq flown at Israel, including in the last days before the ceasefire. So everything ultimately points back to Iran.
All right. Okay. Last statement on this, though. As you said, with the vice ambassador, with the statements, et cetera, and I get that there are other questions that need to be answered. They are. It just seems that they're not intimidated by Iran. There could be a lot of Iranians there. There could be, an impression that Iran is trying its best to control the region, et cetera, et cetera. At least they take a public stance that doesn't back down to them. If only other governments would act the same way, is my point.
Right. Okay. I agree. I said that is the starting point. You're absolutely right. And the consistency with which they have adhered in the trade that has been ongoing between UAE doesn't mean there are no incidents. There are incidents everywhere. And we have to remember these are Arab countries. They're easily accessible, is my point, and that Iran's tentacles reach out to many places, including UAE or as you see in Yemen, and you see throughout the region. And that is still the core of the, they say the head of the snake, the head of the octopus, whatever it is, it's the head of terror.
Understood. All right. Is the ceasefire still intact?
It is in being honored in the breach, as they say, with certain actions taken by Israel, for instance, in response to violations by Hezbollah, which tried to move people into the south below the Litani. Israel has warned people not to come back yet, because they could easily infiltrate together with civilian populations. People started to rush to come back. Israel fired warning shots at some of the communities to get people not to come back to their villages along the border, many of which have been eliminated in the course of the fighting. And hopefully that area should remain open so that Israel will have easier visibility closer to the border. There were very heavily forested areas and also many communities built up, which gave cover to Hezbollah and all of the things that have been covered. Even just in the hours before the ceasefire, Israel blew up this underground kilometer-long facility where Iranians, by the way, were located, as they were in other places, co-located with the Hezbollah people in developing weapons in the Baqa. And it's not Baqa Valley, because Baqa means valley, so you're saying valley. But that's just a nugget for people for Shabbos. That if you realize the sophistication of the operation and the degree to which they had invested, and when people ask about what Israel did, how much they degraded. There were many who warned Israel that a war with Hezbollah would be fatal for them, that the power that they had, that the, weaponry that they had, which was true. But Israel fought an amazing war, and people in future years will write about the heroism, the courage of the soldiers and what they encountered and how they first eliminated a lot of the facilities. And because I hear comments from people, it's very easy to be an armchair general when you don't have to face the frontline considerations. And this is a long-term consideration, because people are going to be reluctant to go back to the north until they're assured that you're not going to have a cross-border raid. So when you hear about Israel taking certain actions, these are preventative. This is meant to enforce the peace process to have the UNIFIL come down, and UNIFIL has been proven to be feckless and meaningless in the past, as well as the Lebanese army, which was also proven to be powerless and unable to stand up to Hezbollah. So we have to see, will the West live up to it? There's going to be new command centers in Tzfat and in Lebanon, which will be manned with American generals as well as others, forces to oversee and enforce the ceasefire with no American troops on the ground. So it means that you have to rely on Fiji soldiers or soldiers from African countries and others, which have had a questionable record in the past.
And where will those American be? In Tzfat and southern Lebanon?
Right. There'll be two command centers.
That's always scary when there's American representation in a place like southern Lebanon. But I guess if there are no troops there, then we're talking about a minimal number of people, right?
Right. We're not talking about, and not in combat zones.
Right. Understood. All right, so some questions regarding the ceasefire and the deal itself. Does this demonstrate a weakness of Iran? We know that there's a big difference between Hezbollah and Hamas, because the impression is that Hamas has the support, whatever that means, of the people in Gaza, and I know that's a complicated piece. Hezbollah, you know, to what we see on social media and through the news, it doesn't seem like they have so much support among the average Lebanese residents. I'm assuming that that's one of the reasons that a ceasefire up north was more likely than anything regarding Hamas. But does this demonstrate a weakness of Iran? In other words, if one of the arms of that octopus has now, you know, agreed to a ceasefire with Israel, does that demonstrate a weakness of Iran at the moment?
Oh, it's a complicated question. It does demonstrate to the people of Lebanon that the vaunted forces of Hezbollah were vulnerable. We did not eliminate them. They weren't eliminated in this war. The number of rockets they fired, I think 16,000 missiles. They have 150,000. We don't know if they're all operational. Hopefully many of them were destroyed in Israel's actions. I'm sure they were. The leadership has been wiped out, basically down to the commander level, right, which is, it's really remarkable. And again, will be written about in the years ahead, not just the pager incident, which obviously captured everybody's imagination, but the fact that they took out pinpoint cars and apartments and the buildings, giving a advance warning, which is probably unprecedented in urban warfare, and why the experts, and important for the people themselves, our people, to know so they can be reassured in advocating and arguing that the Israeli army operated in the most humane way to avoid civilian casualties to the maximum degree possible against an enemy that hides behind civilian population and wants to see civilians hurt. So number one, I think Hezbollah is standing in Lebanon is greatly reduced. Don't forget, you have a Christian population, you have Sunni Shiite populations that are almost equal, and the economic conditions in Lebanon, once the Paris of the Middle East, have been devastated. So I think people will look for a period of calm. And I know when Nasrallah was killed, many people were giving out candies when they attacked in Syria and eliminated one of the Hezbollah murderers there. People also celebrated. And one of the things that people are not watching, just as a side note, is what's happening in Syria now. The rebels in Syria are fighting near Aleppo. They've made progress against the Syrian army. I'm sure the Russians will now have to rush in and try to help them, but they're tied down in Ukraine. Remember, you have a three-way fight going on between Turkey and Iran and Russia in Syria for control and for position. And it gets very little attention, but there's been very heavy fighting, and the rebel troops have made progress. They've captured, I think, 11 villages on the outskirts of Aleppo. So this, again, is a challenge for Hezbollah and Iran. So the situation in Lebanon itself is that there's a history of good relations with Israel. I remember visiting the Good Fence, going into Lebanon several times. I visited Lebanon the first time in the 60s. They had a Jewish community that was still functioning. There are just a handful of Jews there now, but the community itself doesn't function, obviously. Yeah. So they
No, I'm
I
sorry.
Mean, we can talk about this endlessly because it's such a complicated thing.
No, I know, but it leads to so many questions because I can't keep score on this. Syria, Russia, Turkey. So when they say rebels, are they referring to one of those three representations, or is that a fourth one?
That's the fourth. That's the Syrian rebels backed by America, or some of the forces that were backed by America.
And they have the support of Turkey, or Turkey simply has its own independent goals?
No, Turkey has its own. Turkey's goal is to fight the PKK first and foremost. The Kurdish forces in Syria, based in Syria and northern Iraq, they also have territorial aspirations because it's on their border. They also don't want to see Iran take over because that would pose a threat to them ultimately. You know, that despite the periodic gestures between the countries, the fact is that they are rivals and worse. For Russia, they've invested so heavily in sustaining Assad, providing weapons and providing support, you know, selling him anti-aircraft systems, which Israel successfully has taken out. So each one has a goal, but one of the goals each has is to eliminate the other two and to limit their power in this thing. The rebels are a fourth factor.
You know what's funny? I have a friend who lives a good part of the year in Cyprus. And the other day he said to me, he said, the whole world is talking about how Iran wants to take over the Middle East, and nobody focuses on the fact that Turkey wants to do the same thing. You agree with that?
I agree that Turkey and Erdogan himself have aspirations. He's got messianic visions of himself, I think, based on Soleimani. And I know because he's told me as much. About the role that Turkey played in the Middle East, that we were able, and why, when I kept pressing him about why he pays for the demonstrations on Harbayit, and at first he said, well, how do you know? And I said, look, you know and I know, so let's not go there. And he said, okay, and he went on to a long explanation how they ruled in Jerusalem for 400 years. They kept peace between Muslims, Christians, and Jews, and that they ultimately can't be the caliph if you don't have Jerusalem. And I think he has these kind of aspirations and visions. He's obviously, he's Muslim Brotherhood. He's has broader designs. He had the most powerful army, certainly the largest, I think, Air Force in NATO. Remember that he is a NATO member. He decimated it after the supposed revolution when he killed and fired a lot of the officers, and especially the pilots. I think they got rid of a couple hundred at the time because he believed they were part of conspiracy. So yes, they have broader aspirations. He's building mosques all over the world. He has focused on Europe and Germany. You have millions of Turks who in the third generation, many of them have become radicalized. We've seen it. And many of the people came, you know, were still in the Ataturk tradition, democratic, secular even, but their children today are radicalized.
It's funny, you know, China, Russia, Turkey, they all have, you know, similar aspirations, depending on how you look at it. But the world is so focused on Iran, they take advantage of the fact that, and not only is the world focused on Iran, they're totally mismanaging and mishandling the Iran situation and not even realizing that they're so distracted because of Iran from what other countries are aiming to do as well.
Funny. And remember, what is the bulwark against all of the parties you mentioned? There's only one. That the key to all of this is Israel. And that's why they all want to see Israel contained, or they want to see Israel removed or Israel challenged and tied down. Because for the Chinese and the Belt and Road, their initiative, they've reached out to Iran and to Saudis. They buy all the oil. 85% of the oil from Iran is being bought by the Chinese. They have aspirations there. Russia, clearly, the increased trade, the hosting of the Iranian officials, building ties with them. Remember, this is seen by Muslims as a godless regime, a communist regime that certainly has very little in common with the Ayatollahs and the religious fanaticism of Iran's leadership, when you put that all together, you realize how important Israel is, how important what the outcome of this war is, and why pressing Israel for premature ceasefires and stuff is detrimental to the interests of all, and why the Arab countries would constantly say to us, finish the job, don't let any of them live, because they will only come back to our cancer. They metastasize against us.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored digital radio around the world, the web, NahumSiegel.com, the NahumSiegel Network, and, of course, the beloved NSN app. This Tuesday is Giving Tuesday, but today is Black Friday, so don't wait till Giving Tuesday. Take advantage of the incredible Black Friday special and support JM and AM and the Nahum Siegel Network. You can do so at the pace of $1 a day, one of the greatest bargains, one of the best Black Friday bargains in town. Go to fjbunity.org, fjbunity.org. And we thank you for your support. So there are a couple of things I got to ask you regarding this whole ceasefire. First of all over social media, in the 24 hours after the announcement of the ceasefire, there was a report that Senator Cruz had accused or had revealed that President Biden had threatened Prime Minister Netanyahu that if, in fact, you don't take the ceasefire now and, you know, parenthetically make me look good, then we're going to stop all weapons deliveries to Israel. Now, I was not able to authenticate any of this. You have no idea on social media if a senator or anybody like that actually said this or not. But what do you think of the whole pressure on Netanyahu angle of this current ceasefire?
We will learn more and more about it. I have talked about this for a long time because the evidence was there. Israelis spoke about it. And despite the fact that it can become contentious, and the relationship with the United States is very complex, very important. Weapons did continue to come, but they were at a low level. What Israel needed and perhaps could have used in actions against Iran. And remember, the United States, the Prime Minister has to take into account that the United States put a B-52 there, that they have the THAAD missile defense system, that the aircraft carriers were there. They're now there now. But there are destroyers. There's all sorts of naval presence in the Mediterranean and in the Red Sea. That it's far more complex. The relationship with CENTCOM is vital to Israel, and they have been cooperating all along. But yes, as we learned in the last 24, 48 hours in some of the discussions in the Knesset about the ceasefire, they were withholding equipment. Now the United States announced almost $700 million sale. But this is equipment that was essential. Israel was running low on ammunition, and you can't just manufacture it. There's very few places you can buy it. The United States is short of it. We provide so much to Ukraine, including the prepositioned material, $1 billion worth of stuff that was located in Israel that was all moved to Ukraine before the war and not replaced and replenished as it was supposed to be. I think we will learn a lot more about some of the pressures that were brought to bear, including there's talk of something, a concern I mentioned a long time ago about whether they would do something at the UN or not do something, meaning allow some sort of a resolution to get through. They just recently vetoed a resolution, the only one in the Security Council to stand up, which means that if they just simply stand on their hands, we could end up with a recognition of a Palestinian state or some other measure. So there are a lot of pressure points. People jump to conclusions about what the prime minister does or doesn't do or why Israel has to make certain decisions. There's much more to it than people know, more will come out.
In this case, I think he basically said it. He said it without actually saying it directly. If you pay careful attention to his speech as he announced, you know, the ceasefire.
He did say it.
Yeah,
he said it.
Right.
You're right. You're
exactly.
Right. He did say it.
He said it, but if someone challenged it, he could say he didn't really say it, but he said it. So it was right there in his own speech. The other thing is, I need to know if you agree or not. I mean, now everyone's asking, what about Gaza? Are the two differences, number one, that there really is more support for Hamas in Gaza than there is support for Hezbollah in Lebanon? That's the first piece. And the second piece, of course, is the hostages. Who's ready to make a deal if the hostages are not, going to be released as part of that deal? Are those basically the two differences when people ask why can't there be a deal now with Hamas if there's one with Hezbollah?
Those are two. First of all, you have histories that are different. The constituencies are different. But if you look in Yehuda Shomron, they just finished a poll this week, which showed still, if there were an election today, Hamas would swamp Fatah.
Wow.
And like about 40% to 17%, something in that range. And in Gaza itself, the support for October 7th has dropped precipitously all along. They're seeing the destruction of the entire area. But remember, food was flowing in and all these accusations of starvation and stuff. Well, look at 2 billion pounds of food were sent in over the period by Israel. You have trucks lined up, hundreds of them, on the Palestinian side. You saw all the hijacking and stuff. So the people themselves, can get access to food and stuff. It's very expensive. I don't understand where all the money still comes from that they can buy this. There are many mysteries to me about all that is going on. But there are fundamental differences with the degree of entrenchment. And the Israel has done an amazing job in Gaza. But when you realize that the whole area was covered in tunnels and that there things are booby-trapped, you still see guys falling in action because of ambushes, because of the booby traps and because of the IEDs and other things. So there are different circumstances. And, for instance, you don't have a foreign European country like France with influence in Lebanon, and you don't have in Qatar plays a role, but is diminishing it and pulled out of the negotiating role. But it's a Muslim brother country that has supported Hamas all along. And the Hamas leadership's elimination still has those units that were in the field operating. They have no leadership. Right. They can't do what they could do before, and they don't have 100,000 missiles left. You don't see the daily barrages anymore of missiles coming from there. So, yes, there are fundamental differences between the two.
By the way, I don't know if you saw I mentioned this earlier. It was up on the screen here in front of me. The commercial the State of Israel is now sponsored. It's very effective about the fact that 101 hostages, holiday time. Now it's the holiday season, of course. Holiday time and not spending with their families. I mean, it was really done well. And the reason I pointed it out is because it's so hard. It's 420 days. It is hard to keep them at the forefront anywhere. That's why I said kol hakavod to all the people who are making weddings, and they make sure at least during the chuppah to have some type of acknowledgement of what the hostages and soldiers are going through in Israel. And with that in mind, we should mention the terror attack in Ariel this morning. There are some who are seriously wounded. Add them to the list of those who need to be prayed for. It's just nonstop. So obviously the hostages are a major part of any potential deal with Hamas, but it's dragging on. And I don't know, it's funny, when Netanyahu was speaking, I sort of said to myself, when we're back to the arms thing, I sort of said to myself, wow, it looks like he's sort of saying, can't wait for the Trump administration. Do you think that there's a possibility that once Trump takes over January 20th, and I know we don't want to wait till then, but you get my point, that there'll be some type of immediate deal that'll include the hostages?
First of all, it's impossible to predict when you're dealing with these crazy people, extremists who are driven by ideology. By every logical thing, they would have given up 6 months ago or longer or a year ago or would have stopped this when they see the destruction. But the problem is that the leadership was not paying a price. Now, when they do, second of all, we already see how some countries are adjusting to the prospect of a Trump administration, wanting to get on their good side and wanting to, and it's often the unpredictability that is the strongest weapon
right.
that the United States has.
And you don't know what he may do. Right.
I remember with Bush when he was, when we had 150,000 troops on the Iranian border in Iraq,
right.
had we moved then, the Iranians would have done nothing. They were, I know from leaders who have told me how much they really thought he was crazy enough to do it. And I think they think the same thing of Trump, which is a big asset, but we have to be prepared to really crack down on Iran and to stop any transfer. And you know that the President Trump said that that is something we'll do. And if you see the people they appointed, they are people who are oriented in that direction. He doesn't want any boots on the ground. He doesn't want to have America involved directly. But we have the facilities in the region, the capabilities that we have to be prepared to use, because if they believe that the United States won't set their aircraft carriers, if we did over there, they, you know, remember Americans took a part in defending Israel against the barrage of rockets, and America has been acting in Syria against Iranian depots and resources there on a consistent basis, including in the last week. You don't read about much of it, but they are doing it. They do it in response to attacks on American personnel facilities in Syria, which is very limited. So there's a lot going on that, you know, we have to take all of that into account. But yes, I think the change in government leaves many of them, could create opportunities. And most of all, it has to be a forceful message, and that Iran and others, they're bullies. That's terrorists are by nature bullies, and they will step back in the face of real resistance. And America has to build up our military capacity so that it's a more credible threat.
You know why I was happy that the protesters decided to disrupt the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade?
Because, so the world sees what they are.
Well, not just that. I knew because the parade is such kudshim, excuse the expression. But, you know, in the United States, especially in New York, you know, the parade is the holy of holies. I knew that if they went ahead and tried to protest during the parade, they'd be dealt with appropriately. And sure enough, 25 of them were hauled off and arrested. And pretty quickly, if you see how the police moved, it was pretty quick to get them out of the way. And how I wish that the NYPD and, in general, our public safety officials would view all New York streets and landmarks and neighborhoods, including the Jewish neighborhoods of Brooklyn, New York, I wish they would consider them, you know, places that have no place for protests like that, like the parade, and haul people off the way they did yesterday. So I was happy they used the parade as a venue. I don't know what you felt, but that was my take on it.
I agree with what you said. People don't know that the parade is one of the most watched. Next, I think, to in terms of sports events and other things, it doesn't reach Super Sunday, but it is one of the most watched events of the year. I mean, literally around the world, around the country, certainly. But it's far beyond New York, so I think that they were afraid about how New York would be portrayed by allowing this to take place. But it's time to crack down. Now with the ceasefire, with the efforts, it's really time to stop these things, the threats, the ongoing incidents.
And the as campuses. You know,
there are many, many. And for some reason, it seems the police have been allowing them to come closer to venues.
Yep.
And I personally experienced it trying to get into to dinner with the president.
And your neighborhood.
And right near me, absolutely, and getting so close to the shul, this is not something that she permitted. You have free expression. There are can be roped off areas a block away, but to allow the confrontation and police then intercede and they stop, they don't allow violence against the people, but there have been incidents and sometimes not enough of a presence. But I agree with you. It's time to put the markers down to say this. When they violate the law, free speech is protected. But there are limits to that too.
Who allows these marches? You know, we know something, you more than I, about public demonstrations. Who ever allows a march through anywhere in New York City? It's all areas that are designated and approved of by the NYPD in advance. Who on earth tolerates that they're marching?
I'm not sure they were approved in advance in the Brooklyn case. I think that this group broke away and marched around the block, the synagogue around that block to a Jewish neighborhood.
Well, once they're doing that, shouldn't there be a crackdown the second they decide to do that?
Absolutely. They should have been blocked and prevented from doing it. But, you know, you break away. I saw it at the incidents at the Plaza Hotel where the president of Israel was, how cleverly they manipulated around the police. Maybe there wasn't enough of a presence,
right,
but they were guarding the front doors and they moved to the side door. And the police then moved to the side door and they moved to the other side. And here you had the president of Israel, you had a heavily Jewish audience, and the police, you know, manned this the barricades, but they were on the steps of the hotel. They should have been a block away.
Yep.
So I don't know if this is a change in practice or if it's, you know, not enough manpower, but whatever. This there has to be much tougher enforcement.
Understood. All right. And finally, did the ceasefire change Israelis' attitude toward Bibi? Like, is he now, I don't know, more popular or, you know, not only beloved by the right wing, but now by everybody? Has the attitude toward him changed in the light of the ceasefire?
I wouldn't say beloved by by everybody, but I think people understand more what he is trying to do. And if he can really get a ceasefire and that holds, and he's able to get the hostages and move the agendas, I think people, as they find out more and more the pressures that were on Israel, the threats against Israel, not just against him and Gallant by the international court, which they are challenging, but the fact that they, if they took care of Iran, as which uses Hezbollah as a forward operating base against Israel, changes and the threats that come from Yudin Shomron and how that has been controlled by the IDF, which was a front that could be even more dangerous than the other two, being in the heart of Israel. What they were facing when you see weapons being flown in from Egypt on a drone, and how many fronts that Israel has to face, including the prospect that Hezbollah was going to use chemical weapons against troops. I mean, there are just so many aspects that come out. And people begin to get a better understanding. I think his political situation will remain challenged. The economic realities will set in. Some of the international economic experts are giving positive projections, but say that the burdens and the rating cuts are not changing their ratings on Israel yet, but said that they believed Israel would come back from in many regards. But with 46,000 small businesses are destroyed, when all the farming, the economics, all of the burdens that will be on Israel are going to be amazing, and all of us have to step up to the plate after we take care of JM and the AM to support the needs in Israel.
Thank you very much for that. Another nugget, by the way, you mentioned the one about Becca. People could bring up at the Shabbos table tonight why the 29th of November, Chavtet November, is an important date in modern Jewish history. And by the way, we should know Netanyahu is now allowed back in France, right? That was the message that Macron gave him?
Well, there's a sort of mixed messages, but Macron said that
they wouldn't arrest
him. They wouldn't honor it. The foreign minister says, you've seen the foreign minister of Britain also. I mean, there are mixed messages that are being sent, I'm not sure that he's about to visit France too soon anyway.
Yeah. Appreciate you doing this on Black Friday. I'm sure you had other shopping plans for today. So thank you so much.
Yeah, that's me, right.
Have a wonderful
day. With all the problems that we have. But I hope people will make it Green Friday for you.
Nice.
Appreciate properly all that you do throughout the year, throughout the week, and especially on Fridays. It's an important time for them to show Hakaras HaTov, because we're going to have a very busy year ahead, and whatever sources of information that are reliable like this that are available are more and more important.
Much appreciated. Thank you, Malcolm. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Malcolm Honlein, weekly update, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations. His recommendation, which I appreciate, I did not solicit that. He did that on his own. I appreciate it very much. His recommendation is keep us going, everybody. It's been a lot of decades, a lot of years, but we are doing what he just described, giving you reliable news every single day and every single week, especially on Friday morning. So please give and give generously to our year-end campaign. It's a great Black Friday special. $1 a day for every day you listen, whether you're listening every weekday for $250. If you listen every day, including Saturday night and Sunday, so $360. Whatever it is, it's a $1-a-day bargain on this Black Friday. FJBUnity.org, FJBUnity.org, and I thank you.